The Global Privacy Podcast with Nadia Ishak.
Hello, welcome to the Global Privacy Podcast. I'm your host, Nadia Ishak. The concept behind this show is to shed light on privacy laws around the world. I promise to travel to some of the farer regions across the globe and unpack some of the developments happening in the world of privacy, the real impact that these developments have, and some of the global trends that are emerging with regard to how data is being regulated. Today, I have with me Heather Federman. Heather is the Chief Privacy Officer at Big ID, a New York-based data management company where she leads privacy strategy and privacy programs. She is focused on internal compliance and data risk, product development, go-to-market strategy, business development, and privacy evangelism. Prior to this, she was Director of Privacy and Data Risk at Macy's, Inc., where she managed policies, programs, communications, and training. She was also Senior Privacy Manager at Amex and focusing on Amex's global brand marketing and digital partnerships. She served as a legal and policy fellow for the Future for Privacy Forum and as the public policy director for the Online Trust Alliance, where she worked with companies, regulators, and advocates to further FPF's mission in advancing responsible data practices, as well as advancing OTA's mission in establishing trust in the online ecosystem. Heather and I are going to speak today about data regulation as a barrier to trade, data nationalism, geopolitics, and everything in between. Thank you so much for being here today, Heather. Let's start with Big ID. What caps you wear as Chief Privacy Officer and how you got there?
So I think the interesting thing with my role here at Big ID as CPO, it's pretty unique because I'm here in a small, medium-sized business, basically creating their privacy program and doing all the things that a privacy professional really has to do, which is figuring out what are the gaps, what do we need to build, doing our internal privacy policy, as well as our external privacy notice, figuring out how to data map, figuring out what are our various data transfers. We're a small, but we're a global organization. So there are challenges all over the place and essentially building out a team and getting the company comfortable with privacy. The other exciting part of what I do is being able to work closely with the product team on strategy and development, and also getting to be the evangelist on all privacy-related topics for the company.
Nice. And as a company that has reach in more than one country, you can speak a little bit about, you know, what global trends are. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think part of the challenge that we're seeing is this rise in data nationalism. And it's part of, I think, a larger trend of just more nationalism in general, this era of global free trade that I think we all thought would be happening the last 30, 40 years. It's kind of going in reverse now. And so we as privacy professionals are getting caught up in that because many of these various laws or enforcement actions around these laws are basically saying, you need to keep data within our borders for XYZ reason. And the reasons, while they matter, I mean, they're just one part of it, because then you're left holding the bag, figuring out, well, what am I going to do? Because I'm working in a multinational organization and we still have to run a business. So it's probably one of the reasons why in last year's IAPP EY annual governance report, that data transfers was listed as the most difficult part of a privacy professional's job.
I can appreciate that as a privacy professional myself. So could you sort of speak a little bit about, the reason we're here today is because you wrote this article for the IAPP's Privacy Perspectives on doing business across borders. And you talk about, you know, the serious consequences that the PIPL and GDPR and, you know, upcoming new laws have on doing business. And you talk about data localization. You just mentioned it right now. Can you sort of break that down a little bit? Can you tell us what data localization is so that our audience can sort of understand what the impact of that would be?
Yeah, I can do my best. I can't promise it's the exact legal definition. But I think data localization, data sovereignty, all these things about data in a physical place kind of come in various parts. Is that, And I use GDPR and people as the main example, is that they have this concept of extraterritoriality, is that their law applies. It doesn't matter if you are a company located in America. If you happen to have citizens of the EU or China, then you have to treat those that data that you have on those citizens under those laws. So that's the extraterritoriality part of it, which means you're in scope for those laws and brings you in and you have to deal with compliance. The other part of it is that some of these laws have rules around transferring data outside of the borders of those laws. And there are some countries that have very, very specific strict measures about this. Like in Russia, even before this conflict, they basically said you have to keep the data of Russian citizens within Russia. So this was already kind of starting to become a thing, even, you know, a few years before GDPR and people really kind of came to the fore with these sort of things. And with GDPR, what kind of really brought this up was that you have to have a legal transfer mechanism for transferring data outside of the EU. And many companies were relying on these internationally agreed upon trade agreements. Originally, it was the EU-US safe harbor, but then that got invalidated by the highest court in Europe. And they came up with another version of it, the US-EU privacy shield. And then last summer of 2021, it got struck down again. So now companies are trying to figure out what to do. There's an updated version of what's called standard contractual clauses, which is a very specific legal mechanism. It's just basically a long, you know, extra bunch of clauses that you have to add to any sort of agreement that you have with, say, with a vendor that's dealing with the EU. And it's one form of a legal transfer mechanism. It also requires doing some sort of assessment called a transfer impact assessment or TIA to figure out, you know, can I transfer data to the US? And for the EU, part of the main concern was that the US doesn't have a mechanism called redress. So the ability for an EU individual to say, hey, I don't like how you're using this data. I want to go to some ombudsman and say, you know, I want to sue this company for my data. They felt that they didn't really have that. And that our surveillance mechanisms were just, you know, all over the place and could do whatever they wanted to do with EU data, regardless of the fact that the EU has their own version of surveillance laws, but that's a different discussion. So that's kind of what's happening in the EU. And I mean, it's gotten to the point where there are various companies that are debating whether or not they fully pull out of the EU, which is a huge market share. And would, I mean, I'll be fascinated to see if any companies actually do that in the next year or so. China is in some ways a bit more of a, I'd say, not simple story, but a little less complicated in terms of the back and forth that's happened around data transfers. People is largely based off of the GDPR in terms of how it was set up. However, people is, their privacy law is part of one of various laws that China released in the last several years around data. They have a data security law, they have this privacy law, and then they have laws around data transfers. And basically, if you are transferring data outside of China, then you have to go through a very strict assessment that is going to be subject to a regulator. And what that looks like is still very up in the air, and it's unclear as to whether a regulator is going to say yes or no, you can actually transfer data outside of this jurisdiction. So these are some of the challenges that companies are facing. And China is also another region where many multinational companies have businesses there. Some have decided to fully pull out, not just because of people, but because of other issues that are happening there. But there are other companies, like we have customers that are trying to figure out what can they do because they don't have that choice. They have to do business in China. Otherwise, they're going to lose a huge market share. So a lot of this is really impacting how businesses around the world are really run.
Thank you. I mean, I can speak for myself as, you know, we update SECs because there have been several versions of the standard contractual clauses. How do you think companies are going to respond if, for example, another jurisdiction were to come up with its own sort of set of processes for or regulations to for transfer of data, sort of like the SECs that we have right now in play with Europe and the UK?
Yeah. I mean, I think to your point, because I was going to actually mention the UK, I think when the GDPR stuff happened, it was really shocking to the privacy community, but now it's kind of changed where it's more of an expectation that this is going to happen with other jurisdictions. And we just have to kind of figure out how we're going to make this work. Because I mean, you mentioned the UK, and right now the way agreements are very up in the air about, you know, well, the UK right now is subject to the old version of standard contractual clauses, but they might come up with a new version. There's a question for these other privacy laws that are coming out all over the world as to whether there's going to be data transfer or data localization requirements. India is probably the one that's most concerning to privacy professionals. I mean, that law has not come out yet. It's been in bill form for the last several years, but it seems that there's relative consensus that there will be some form of a localization requirement. So I think others kind of sense that this isn't going away anytime soon, that this is just going to become more and more of a trend. And I mean, I'm sure that as we see other privacy laws that have come out in the last few years, as they start to mature and there's more case law around them, we'll get a better sense of what regulators are thinking. I mean, we're not really even talking about Brazil here, but I'm curious with Brazil. I mean, they've created a whole new agency to deal with privacy. And, you know, they're probably going to look to their counterparts in the EU because they basically modeled their law also off the GDPR. And they might say, well, maybe we should also keep data in Brazil. It's unclear. But I mean, I think what is clear is that it's just going to continue to be an issue. It's just a question of when and what country.
And also there's this idea that, you know, what exists today will change within a jurisdiction over time as well, as we've seen with the SECs and the EU. So in your article, you talk about, you know, these regulations or these requirements as barriers to trade, as non-tariff barriers. Can you talk a little bit about that? And can you talk a little bit about consumer loss and sort of, you know, how you see this panning out in, you know, as, you know, more countries come up with their own set of standards?
Yeah, I think what was part of the reason I wrote this article was I've been really interested in geopolitics the last year or so. But when I'm reading books about this sort of stuff, there's really no discussion around data or digital trade. It's mostly focused on physical goods and land barriers and things like that. And, you know, that part is very fascinating, interesting, and highly important and relevant, and explains a lot about what's happening in the world today. But we live in a digital world, so I think the geopolitical community is kind of missing out on having these really important discussions around trade, because if we're enacting a law that is making it a harder barrier to have a business work in, or, you know, give offer its products and services to consumers in that market, then it's ultimately the consumers of that market that are going to lose out. So there was one company I was speaking to last summer, and they were a smaller company dealing with HR stuff. And they said to me point blank that they're not even going to bother trying to go into Europe because they just don't even want to deal or touch GDPR. So, you know, and I don't know if we're going to be able to get statistics on, you know, how many companies have that mindset, but that's going to be the ultimate loss, is that you're going to start to see more of these little pockets and bubbles of interesting companies doing interesting things, but they're not really able to expand. And I'm not really concerned about like these big tech companies in terms of their ability to expand. I mean, it's kind of ultimately up to them if they choose to or choose not to, but they at least have the power and the money to do that. If you're a smaller company, it's much more of a question as to, do you want to spend the money to have, let's say, a local data server have a segregated copy of data in that jurisdiction versus being able to just, you know, have your data hosted in one center and not have to worry about all these other rules and regulations and wondering if you're going to come out with a major enforcement fine or get kicked out of a country or even in some potentially a criminal penalty. So I think we're going to start to see this in the next several years. We're just at the very, very beginning. But I mean, to me, this is my biggest concern, is that it's really ultimately the consumers of these various marketplaces that are going to be losing out on whatever innovative businesses are being created right now.
Do you think that there's also a trade-off with the protection of data? You know, so the harder it is to comply, do you think that, you know, some companies just would give up complying, you know, and sort of cross that bridge, you know, when it becomes necessary? Or is the risk too high to not comply, so they'll just pull out completely?
I think it depends. I mean, you know, if I'm for my company, I kind of look at what are the tools that the regulator has in play. And I think what made GDPR so scary for so many companies is that the enforcement fines are massive. I mean, it's up to 4% of global annual turnover for a willful violation of GDPR. China, I think, has something similar. And it's, you know, so I think when you see that these enforcement fines are so high and can have such an impact on your daily business, that's when you might say it's not even worth trying. Or if I'm going to do it, I have to do it up to T. I think the other challenge that I'm starting to get concerned with is I've always taken a very risk-based approach when it comes to doing privacy. I mean, it's how I was trained and it's how I kind of look at this whole world as, you know, is my use of using data in this capacity and at this sensitivity level in this fashion, how risky is it going to be? Where I think some of these regulators, I think especially in Europe, and it's too soon to tell with China, but they're just taking a blanket yes or no approach, depending on what you're doing. And my example there is with regards to the recent Google Analytics cases, where, I mean, there are some challenges with cookies and analytics, but I mean, this is relatively innocuous compared to doing something, let's say, with facial recognition, which is a biometric footprint, which is highly sensitive data. So being able to say, you know, full stop, no use of Google Analytics because, you know, it's located in the US, therefore you can't use it. I mean, there's no risk review on the part of the regulators. They're just saying, you know, nope, you're done. And that to me is what I think is what a company has to say to themselves, is it even worth doing this at all? Because these regulators are not even going to, you know, be lenient when it comes to, you know, potentially me using this analytic company because it might be helpful for me to do my marketing or, you know, website related activity. That's kind of where things I think are really up in the air right now.
Jumping off from that and segueing to one of my favorite topics is this concept of surveillance, which was the premise of Schrems 2 and how inadequacy in the United States was invalidated. What role do you see surveillance playing with the standardization of global privacy compliance? How do you see this playing out, and especially with countries, you know, countries like China, where the extent of its surveillance is largely unknown, and, you know, and they're enacting privacy laws?
Yeah. I think what's interesting is that we've done a good job for a long time of bifurcating consumer privacy related issues with surveillance issues. You know, we've put them in separate buckets. And I think for let's say, you know, 80% of your daily use cases as a privacy professional, that's pretty okay. Because, you know, if I'm not dealing with surveillance requests in my normal daily life, then I don't need to think about it that often. But I do think that when we do kind of take that larger view, surveillance is very culture, to your point, it's very culture dependent, and it's very context dependent as well. Because leniency towards surveillance can change depending on, let's say, if there's some sort of security need. We've seen throughout history when, you know, we're willing to give up some of our liberties because of security concerns. And sometimes they're really valid. I don't want to say that it's not valid. I think we just have to keep in mind that the authority that's doing that surveillance, it's not necessarily going to give you back whatever it took away or stop doing that surveillance. You know, these are the things we have to kind of keep in mind and what are the trade-offs we're willing to make. You know, the two examples that are in my head just kind of right now are September 11th in New York City and in America really changed the name of the game when it came to surveillance. And that's where, you know, stuff around the NSA and the DHS really did come into play, which I guess we see the ramifications of how Europe freaked out about that years later during the Snowden revelations. And those, I mean, our surveillance mechanisms haven't really gone away. I think there are reasons for that, whether or not they're actually good. That's a whole other discussion we can get into. And then, you know, with this recent Ukraine-Russia crisis, you know, the article today was about how the Ukrainian government, I believe, is planning to deploy Clearview AI. And for folks that don't know, Clearview AI is basically a company that has scraped various social media websites for pictures of people all over the world and use that into making it a facial recognition database. So here in the US, we really freaked out about using this and about law enforcement departments using this. But all of a sudden in the Ukraine, when they're in the middle of a crisis, they say, no, let's use this technology because we can identify, you know, enemies on the other side who might be hanging out and we're not aware of them. So, I mean, things change and the context changes. And I can't answer just me whether or not that's a good thing or not a good thing, because I'm not the one, thankfully, at this moment dealing right now with a, you know, a crisis like that. But these are things that the privacy community does have to ask when it comes to our daily lives. I think China also has, you know, kind of been, China's also a very different world in some ways, or society, than I'd say Western society. And it's very much more about the collective versus the individual. So there might, and I'm not the right person to answer this when it comes to, you know, how they might feel about surveillance versus other cultures, but I get the sense that it's because it's more of an emphasis on the collective versus the individual, it might not be as big of an issue as it is perhaps in more Western countries.
Regulators need to be cognizant of that as well. And I speak specifically now with regard to Europe, just because this is where it was confronted. But do you think the expectation that surveillance or, you know, state protection of data is going to be consistent around the world is something that is obtainable, or, you know, it should be a goal?
I don't think it's obtainable. I was actually doing a privacy training, I think a month or so ago, and someone in the class asked me, you know, why isn't there one global privacy law? And if we lived in an ideal world, I mean, if we lived in an ideal world, we probably wouldn't even need a privacy law. But if we lived, let's say, in an ideal world that's all about globalization to the T, then yes, we would have one. But we're never going to live in that world, especially not now. So I think this idea that, you know, different country, I think we have to be realistic, and that different countries are going to have different concepts of what security is to them, what it means to them, and what information they're going to require in order to be protective. I mean, I was in Israel recently, and my experience of going through security when I was leaving the country was completely different than my experience of going through security anytime I'm flying out of somewhere in the United States. So I'm not the person to answer which one is better. I mean, I have my personal opinions, but I think how countries view security and how that ties to the data that they have about me is a really interesting question. I do think, just to kind of also throw this in there, one challenge that has been around in privacy for a while before, you know, in addition to, let's say, these things around data protectionism and nationalism, is about the ability of me as an individual to say to a company or, let's say, a government, you know, I want to know what data you have about me because you might be making a false inference about me. I have a friend that I work with, and, you know, he jokingly complains that every time he goes through security leaving America, he has to do like go through a 2-hour questioning, and, you know, they go through all of his luggage, and question him about many things. So, I mean, it's clear that he's on some sort of like red flying list, but he doesn't know what for and he doesn't know why. So generally speaking, it would be nice in, let's say, a more, maybe not an ideal world, but like a more open, transparent world is if my friend would be able to know, you know, why he's on this no fly or red fly list and have the chance to maybe clear his name and prove himself wrong and say, no, I'm actually a pretty normal, nice person.
So from an operational perspective, so perhaps not from a sort of a regulatory perspective, but there will be a point when the two merge. Do you see any kind of standardization that could take place that would make, you know, life for businesses, you know, grappling? Because there are these polarized concepts that we're dealing with. But could there be some minimum standard or some middle ground that you'd like to see?
I guess part of it is, you know, one other thing I've been trained in, and one of the things I love about Big ID is really starting with the data. It's that you have to have a very clear foundation of what data do you have, whose data does it, you know, tie to, and where is that data located? So part of what we're doing now with all of these various, let's say, transfer impact assessments is I think, you know, yes, there's going to be very specific requirements for the EU to the US or EU to, I don't know, some other non-adequate country versus China versus this other situation. But generally speaking, I need to know, you know, whose data do I have? Where is it flowing? How does this particular business unit within my company use data? You know, where are their team members located? What are the controls that we have in place? Do we need to put controls in place? So I think from the operational side, it's just really kind of doing that data mapping foundation exercise and, you know, just putting a bit more emphasis on, you know, where folks are potentially located. This also plays into, let's say, every company has to deal to a certain extent with vendor risk. So, you know, we need to understand where our vendors are located, not just where the vendor, you know, a vendor might say they're in the US, but do they have subcontractors in, you know, another country? And is that a country that has their own data protection laws and are they accessing it and is there adequacy there? So I think it's just doing what you're doing, but potentially kind of having to extend some of this work out. You know, I kind of try to be as practical as possible when it comes to these things. So I kind of take like the 80%, 80-20 rule, that what is the 80% of the commonality that I can achieve, let's say through my data mapping exercise. And then where is the 20% that I might need to focus specifically on what an EU regulator is going to need? And I mean, is that the sort of thing that I have to outsource to a consultant or to counsel or to something like that? Because I might know how to operationalize a privacy program. But the one thing I think I remain consistent in is that you can't do everything. So where are the areas that you're going to need help, whether it's through extra knowledge, technology, or some sort of process in place?
That sounds great. Thank you very much for that. My personal view is that it is a pipe dream that standardization is, you know, we're all going to know what, you know, what privacy protections we ought to give our data subjects. And, you know, we're all going to follow the same laws and have the same requirements and everyone's going to, you know, that's where I'd like to see the world go. But I recognize that that is a pipe dream.
For what it's worth, there are efforts, you know, to do standardization in the privacy community. I mean, some folks have taken GDPR as the standard that they want to follow. And that's actually not a bad thing to do because there's so many laws that are based off of GDPR. I think another interesting example is the NIST privacy standards, because I think they've done a very good job of mapping out what are the controls you need to put in place in order to operationalize privacy. The one thing I think that's interesting with NIST is because it's a US-based standard, are you going to have privacy programs not based in the US say, oh, we don't want to base ourselves off of the US standard because we have issues with US law, which ultimately does a disservice because NIST has done a pretty good job with their privacy standards. But I think that's part of the challenge is that, you know, there are standards that are out there, but there's going to be inherent biases built into various standards. So I don't know in terms of that pipe dream, I don't know if we could ever fully get beyond those biases in order to have one standard that everyone is following.
If it was easy, it would be done already, right?
Exactly.
So we're moving on to the next section. And this is a very, just a quick sort of, I like to throw these quick questions out just to see, you know, where your thoughts are at. And the first one's an easy one. Do you have a piece of fiction, of a movie or a show or a book that, you know, showcases privacy or talks about privacy or what the world would look like in a dystopian world with no privacy?
This is actually like one of my favorite topics to discuss. I think it depends on what day you ask me and what book I'm reading. You know, one thing that I heard from a friend years ago, and it came up again recently, is that the most realistic version of our future is WALL-E, which is the Disney movie about the little robot. But then if you remember the humans on the ship and, you know, they basically don't do anything. So I do think that there is an avenue that that could become our version of dystopia. I have long been a fan of George Orwell's 1984. You know, I think like the idea of the telescreen is essentially like our smartphones today. I've also been a fan of Kafka's The Trial in terms of just, you know, the lack of transparency as to why you might be in jail, I think is something that we're really grappling with. I think there's so many interesting examples of science fiction and dystopia. I mean, you could just watch almost any episode of Black Mirror to kind of, you know, see a version of reality that, you know, kind of hits close to the surface. The most recent one I've seen was the show on Amazon called Upload. And that's about, you know, your digital afterlife, but it also deals with capitalism and, you know, concepts of, you know, I mean, it touches upon various technologies, but I think it's also an interesting concept as well. So there's so many materials out there around science fiction. I think it's such an interesting ripe time for sci-fi dystopian topics.
Awesome. I haven't checked out Upload. I will be checking it out. So here's another question. Who do you think will be the regional leader for privacy in the United States and in Asia? Because we've spoken about those two.
You know, I think, I mean, you could, so I guess the default answer you could say is California. California has done a pretty good job of being the first when it comes to many various laws. They are also the only state privacy law that has their own independent agency to regulate that law. So I'll be curious in like 5 years from now, what sort of case law has come out of that. But I think what we are seeing also is that there's a lot of lobbying going on around the states, because the idea that, I mean, myself included, but many are thinking that federal privacy legislation, at least let's say for the next 5 years, is a pipe dream. So pushing state privacy laws that are very low level for companies to follow. So many companies, I think, might look at things and say, okay, we've got the California model, we have these other state models. And from what I'm hearing is that they'll offer, you know, some general form of data, you know, consumer rights. But when it comes to employee privacy, which is a whole other topic, you know, that's only going to be California, because that right now that's the only state that requires or allows employees to access those sort of data rights. In terms of Asia, I mean, you could also say China to a certain extent, but I think China is also kind of its own unique use case. I'll be curious to see what happens, you know, with Japan as they want to do an amendment to their laws. India is still very much up in the air. Australia is also an open question. I think when it comes to the whole Asia, the APAC region, who, let's say, the leader is still really up for debate. I think if you ask me that in like 5-10 years from now, we'll have a better sense of, you know, who's going to be that leader, because it's not just the law, it's how that law also gets enforced.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Heather. This has been such a fascinating conversation. I'm really glad that you came on. I thought the article, for anyone who wants to check it out, it's on the IAPP's Privacy Perspectives. It is titled,
I think it's Beyond Borders.
Beyond Borders. Yeah.
Something around beyond borders. Yeah.
It's called Doing Business Across Borders, A Global Future or a Splintered Internet. I'm looking forward to everything else that you're going to bring, whatever you write next. And I'm really thankful that you were able to make it on this, show.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation with you today.
The Global Privacy Podcast with Nadia Ishak.